Hello and welcome to another installment of K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show.
Good evening, Chinatown.
My name is Steve Cato, and I am joined here in the spacious Chinatown digs of K-Chung Radio by my magnificent co-host, Nicholas Miller.
Hey, Steve. It's always such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I would agree. It's good that Too True have returned to their format.
Thank goodness.
I think it's a relief. I think it's a return to the status quo that was a beautiful status quo and did not need to be shaken up. It was nice to see Jesse Stecklow in the studio with Too True today.
Oh, that guy.
Playing music. Just playing music like like they should on Too True.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Music.
We've got a weird episode for you today, people. And it's weird for a few reasons. One of the reasons why it's weird is that we are not featuring a live person. Normally we have live guests. Today we have a recording, and we've done this in the past. We've done recordings. We've played Robert Ashley's Perfect Lives, for example. We've done a lot of different things like that. And we're doing something pretty different. We're going to play different people talking from a record. And I think one of the things that struck me about this particular project, what we're playing excerpts from, is this project called Word of Mouth, which was the fourth issue of a magazine called Vision. And Vision was normally a magazine, which was curated by Tom Marioni, who had the Museum of Conceptual Art in San Francisco, and was published by Crown Point Press. And this issue was released as an LP, and none of that sounds so weird. Things like this happen all the time. Close radio, all of these different things have existed and certainly existed in abundance in the late 70s and up until the early 80s when everyone lost their National Endowment for the Arts funding. But what's so interesting about this is just the premise behind how this talking was produced. So Tom Marioni got a lot of people on one of the Caroline Islands in the Pacific Ocean called Ponape, and it's halfway between Hawaii and Japan, north of Australia. And pardon me, he got 37 people to meet on a week in January 1980, and there were talks by 12 artists before and after dinner, and during the day people could just explore. And what an amazing setup, right, Nicholas?
Oh, man, that's incredible. I can't even imagine getting 30 people from Los Angeles to go at the same time to Joshua Tree. I mean, that seems preposterous.
Indeed, it's almost like being asked to go to Switzerland every year to eat a meal, and then that's it. You can do whatever you want. It is that ridiculous a setup. And you wonder how it was paid for. You wonder how it worked out. One account I heard was that the Americans and the Europeans mostly stuck together in clumps by the end of the week. The list of people invited were truly stellar. Robert Kushner, Marina Abramović, John Cage, Daniel Buren, Joan Jonas, Brian Hunt, Chris Burden, who must have been quite young at the time, William T. Wiley, Bryce Marden, Pat Steer, and Laurie Anderson, who was also quite young at the time. And it is just really strange. It is a really strange way of inducing talking, and it is a really strange move to bring A, to bring work to a place like that and then present it to people, and B, to take that material that occurred in this very strange context away from that context and return it to our world here. Very strange. Really weird. So each segment is about 10, 12 minutes long. So let's just get started. All right, we're going to start with Tom Marioni, who's going to explain the record a little bit and explain his approach to non-objective art.
I have this Museum of Conceptual Art in downtown San Francisco. The building is owned by the city, and they give it to me rent-free. In 1974, the agency gave the third floor of this building to another nonprofit organization, the Chinese Youth Alternative. In Chinatown, there are two gangs, the Hong Kong-born called the Hua Qing and the American-born Chinese. The Hua Qing were upstairs from me. They would hold dances up there, have fights, fuck, and sail day-old donuts out the window at pedestrians. After about 6 months, they screwed up the plumbing and were evicted. They had demolished the third floor, knocked out the interior walls, and spray-painted English and Chinese graffiti everywhere. I sent out announcements and opened the space as an environmental exhibition, as a sort of West Coast, West Side story. A year later, after a group show of performances by younger artists, one of the artists in this show, which was called Second Generation, had painted a large section of the back wall, ceiling, and floor white to make his performance in. After the show, this white section interfered with the character of the space. It had been a printing company for 50 years before I moved in to make it a museum. Being concerned with traditional museum functions like preservation, collection, and restoration, I have kept the space as a relic of a mechanical age. There have been works built into the architecture of the space, and there's residue from actions made there that have become integrated into the space. About 6 months after the Second Generation show, The Night Watch by Rembrandt was slashed in the State Museum in Amsterdam. They built a special room in the museum with windows around it so the public could see the restoration like sidewalk spectators. The painting was laid out on a large operating table, and it took a year to fix it. This gave me the idea to restore the back wall area of MoCA. Up until this time, there had not been a painting show in MoCA. I asked a painter friend of mine, David Ireland, if he wanted to collaborate with me to fix the space. He built the scaffold to work on the ceiling. Working every day for a month, he scraped the white off the floor and rubbed it with printer's ink to stain it and replaced the moldings that had been cut away. He worked from photographs to match the color on the wall, where there were painted shapes over the years equipment had been painted around, and when the printing company moved out, it left all this evidence of their 50-year history. Each day I would videotape the progress, a kind of time-lapse photography. We were making a photorealist painting, and when the project was done, there was a completely invisible artwork. Until last May, when they went out of business, there was a famous old San Francisco bar downstairs from my museum. Green's Cafe had been used for video exhibitions, radio shows, and most of the social activities for the museum. It was known as the Saloon of MoCA. In 1976, I began hanging out there every Wednesday afternoon with my friends. After a while, I sent cards out announcing 2 to 4, Cafe Society every Wednesday. It turned into a vital social situation, an open house to meet new people. Word got around and visitors even came by from out of town. A lot of beer was drunk. There was communication, and the beer was an aid to communication, a kind of disguised performance where nothing actually happened. I didn't attempt to photograph this activity, although sometimes other people did. I didn't want to take a chance on exposing it as a work of art and so make it static and self-conscious. I've used these three examples to demonstrate some of my attitudes about invisible art. Last summer, we took a freighter across the Pacific Ocean as far as Saipan. We stopped at 4 islands on the way. The first island was Majuro. There were natives there from the Gilbert Islands, and they would go around from island to island singing and performing. There were about 15 of them, and they would all stand or sit cross-legged and perform their stories. They did as many pieces as there were performers in the group, so that each one had a turn as conductor or director. The director would also face the audience and move his hands and arms in very graceful movements, like the hands indicating birds diving in unison. Much more angular and graceful than the hula hands in Hawaiian dancing. The chorus would sing and clap for rhythm, and each conductor had his own style. Some held a board with symbols drawn or woven into it on their laps. This was the score for the story song. They all wore halo-like crowns of straw and small seashells. Some pieces of straw came to a point and radiated out from their heads. The women were braless, but wore men's undershirts to be modest for our sakes. Everyone wore wide collars of straw and shells and belts of straw and shells and things around their ankles with straw and shells. The men wore bandoleros of large shells strung diagonally across their shoulders. Both men and women wore short grass skirts. These people were artists. They worked so together and so sophisticated, this was their work. Old-fashioned to insist performance art is sculpture involved into the fourth dimension. Something I learned from Miles Davis was that by turning his back on the audience when he played, he was an artist working. He said he was a musician, not a performer. I've been holding on to my notion of the sculpture action, where the action is directed at the material I'm manipulating, instead of at the audience like in theater. I can see this as a European attitude about this kind of art. In 70, when I started MoCA as a specialized sculpture action museum, I defined conceptual art as idea-oriented situations not directed at the production of static objects. Now the break from the object isn't an issue anymore. 10 years ago, it was important to make a statement against materialism by not making objects. Now with some artists in my generation, there's a return to the object, not as an end, but as material to explain a function, like before the Renaissance, where the object was used in a social, religious, or architectural way. The 70s was a cosmetic age of decoration and theatricality. Daniel Buren will fuse painting with life. John Cage will fuse music with nature. Chris Burden will fuse technology with sculpture. Robert Kushner will fuse decoration with psyche. Tom Marioni will fuse social activity with sculpture. Pat Steer will fuse geometric with organic. Laurie Anderson will fuse song with sculpture. Bill Wiley will fuse country with city. Brian Hunt will fuse fantasy with sculpture. Marina Abramovich will fuse myth with political action. Joan Jonas will fuse painting and sculpture with theater. Bryce Martin will fuse hashish with wax to make colors of higher intensity. In 1980, everyone will consider themselves artists, and artists will be forced to call themselves something else.
You know, and one of the things that struck me there was just how even though that presentation of non-objective art seems so totally earnest to us right now, it's strange that it's it sounds like the kind of conversation I've had recently.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, talking is your medium, right?
Do you think that's because the sort of financial moves of the 80s have fully loosed deregulated capital in the art market, and therefore things have actually sort of hyper-accelerated, so to speak, towards object-based art?
Well, you know, paintings are still really popular, maybe even more so than so-called object-oriented artworks. I think that has a big part in the art market today and why we see so much sculpture. But people have always liked objects, right? Even before capitalism. So
Or would you argue that that's too simplistic a base and superstructure Marxian analysis of why art is the way it is today compared to the situation Mr. Marioni is describing?
Yeah, I think it's more subtle than just the 80s.
Do you feel like it's a cop-out that he's going back to using stuff, but just using it for himself?
No, it seemed like a genuinely felt experience for him.
I have to say I find it strangely relatable. I mean, I feel like I don't understand what pictures are for, why people would want to look at them, but I understand why I would want to use them, you know, and how that would work for me. And if what I'm doing is the art and I want people to look at the results of that, me using these materials in it somehow, I don't know, seems appropriate.
Yeah, sure. They're like props for you or something.
I wonder. Anyway, on a related note, let's move on to Robert Kushner, self-proclaimed decorative artist. I think this is going to be really fascinating. So let's just let Rob take it away.
This is a rather formal after-dinner talk. A friend of mine who is a biologist told me about the fact that he suddenly had to start speaking at conferences. And with that in mind, I thought that I would prepare a rather precise talk for this conference. It's also a little bit like a bouillon cube, because I took all these ideas and kept shrinking them down so I'd be less than 11 minutes. And I think maybe I oversamprized the talk. But anyway, I want to be talking about decoration in two ways. One, the historical distinction that has arisen between decoration and art, and then my ideas about how to find an acceptable definition for decoration. When I refer to the idea of decoration, I don't mean it merely as a synonym for something that's frilly or fussy. It not only includes rose print wallpapers and crochet doilies, but also much, much more. For example, all Islamic art, including manuscript illumination, which is usually considered non-decorative, the work of almost all weaving cultures throughout the world. This would include Peru, Mesoamerica, all the way across Central Asia and North Africa. Huge numbers of tribal cultures whose primary visual expression is weaving. Fabric, furniture, and architectural traditions in the West, quilts, more recently Art Nouveau, Art Deco. I include a lot of abstract art, particularly such movements as color field painting, and even certain aspects of cubism I maintain are decorative. And of course, artists like Matisse, who's a decorator par excellence. To indicate the breadth of this subject beyond, you know, the trivial, I wanted to quote Amy Golden, who concluded an essay on decoration by saying, "The artists wish to remind you of the possibility of joy beyond reason, of solemnity beyond fear." I, like Miss Golden, do not acknowledge any particular differentiation between the hierarchy of art versus decoration. I think there are interrelated phenomena which often come together, but whose primary characteristics can be identified. I don't think of art as being superior to decoration, nor do I believe that decoration is superior to art, although the temptation is often strong. The distinction between art and decoration hardly existed before the 19th century. At that time, a number of things happened to make people think and write about why so many products of the Industrial Revolution were coming out so miserably ugly. For one thing, there was a great exposition in 1851 in London, where all different countries sent their industrial products, and a lot of them were horrible. Everyone was striving for an understanding as to why design or decoration was not looking so good. Some people decided that this ugliness came from machine production and the loss of the touch of the human hand. It didn't look right, and they tried to formulate a theory of design to arrive at a proper demarcation between the fine arts, which should imitate natural appearance, and the industrial arts, which should avoid that trap. There were other ideas, but the main point was trying to set up definitions for decoration that were different from the criteria you applied to looking at art. At that time, decoration was still a separate but equal activity. And this existed until a book appeared in 1906 by Adolf Loos, who was an Austrian, a Viennese architect, and he entitled his book Ornament and Crime. I think his position was rather clear. And indeed, it did strike a strong blow to decoration's acceptability. It was a rather disgruntled diatribe against applied decoration. And admittedly, there was a lot of very bad applied decoration. His ideas, as well as the ideas of the Vienna Werkstätte, served as a strong foundation for the Bauhaus theory, which has come down rather unquestioned to us today. Yet I found it curious when I saw a number of examples of Loos's work, particularly furniture designs, in an exhibit at the Cooper Hewitt Museum, that there still was a strong decorative content, it was just that it was highly pared down. It was more austere, but it certainly existed. If we carry that Bauhaus tradition further, looking at Mies van der Rohe, who is, I think, an impeccable architect, there still is a decorative content, and Robert Venturi points that out very well in a book called Learning from Las Vegas, where he maintains that certain of Mies's decisions are not based on structure, and they're based on how he wanted the building to look as an overall thing. The real coup de grace came in with non-objective painting. Most people felt at this time that artists had somewhat different intentions from decorators. But everyone, to the uninitiated, the question arose, why do these non-objective paintings, say a Kandinsky or something like that, look so much like wallpaper? The artist's answer was that non-objective painting retained all the spiritual power and meaning of traditional paintings. The abstract artist was free to dwell on the more interesting questions of composition, color, and significance, leaving behind the prissiness of figure drawing, modeling, and theme. The decorator was back in the dust. And the basic understanding that we've had until very recently was established, that is, that art was good, highbrow, and intelligent, while decoration was mere, déclassé, and dumb. before all this business about making a differentiation between the artist and the decorator, artists considered the ability to produce decoration one of their stocks in trade. Leonardo listed innovative plans for carnival and parade floats with his other marketable skills, such as production of war machinery, anatomical studies, and painting, which was the end of his list. Michelangelo served as a decorator in many functions, particularly in relationship to architecture. And as recently as this century, nearly everyone who was working in Paris did some designing for Diaghilev in the Ballet Russe. I recently just found out that Raoul Dufy worked for many years designing many, many commercial silk prints for the silk manufacturer Bianchini Ferrier in Lyon. The only point I'm trying to make is that a clear distinction often gets fuzzy, you know, between the two areas. The main things that I've been thinking about recently, though, are how you can tell if something is decorative or not decorative. And for the use of this talk, something non-decorative I'll refer to as art. I think there's no absolute barometer of decorativeness. And often one's initial response is correct. But there are some clues that help us work it out. After you have this initial response, this thing feels decorative, there are four qualifications that I feel can always be used to test the response. Not every one of these qualifications needs to be present in a work of decoration, but any decorative statement will feature one or more of them. The first one is expansiveness rather than containment. Decoration always seems to expand beyond its edges or to be bigger than its skin. This can happen in various ways. The expansion can be very mild. For example, a simple, even a dumb pattern, by its very definition, has the potential of going on indefinitely. And the expansion can be of a more dramatic quality if a strong movement is truncated before its point of visual completion. And I think almost any of Morris Lewis's paintings serves a very good example of this, particularly the unfurls, where your eye is just carried directly out of the picture. A seemingly paradoxical case is the function of borders in Oriental rugs, which seem to stop any outward movement of the field. If one asks if this is still decorative, the answer is yes, because the border is saying two things at the same time. It is saying that that pattern is capable of going on forever, the field that is, but it is stopping at a certain point right now. This is, I think, a very good summation of the fact that the carpet serves as a portable piece of decoration and defines its own arena of activity. For another example, consider a painter who has produced both decorative and non-decorative works, which are quite similar formally at first glance. I feel that early Mondrian paintings are not decorative. Their strong internal balance results in containment. You're not interested in anything that would be possibly outside the frame. But late ones like Broadway Boogie Woogie or any of those series with a lot of small shapes that just keep bouncing around can be seen as cropped segments of an indefinitely expanded field. And I feel that the sense of outward movement is a signal of decorative intent, whether the artist discussed it in that way or not. The second point concerns iconography and meaning, which serve as secondary importance to the visual experience. In Picasso's Guernica, there are passages of simple pattern which are usually interpreted as being symbolic of newspaper headlines or newspaper copy about the Spanish Civil War. But any decorative qualities they might have are undercut by the force of his pacifist sentiments. And as a decorative painting, if you want to try to make this a work of decoration, it doesn't work. Or consider a classical crucifixion. Sadness, pain, suffering are the mood and the feeling that's stressed. Furthermore, there's usually iconographic content. One would really be feel ridiculous trying to look at this as a decorative painting. But consider a piece of 18th century clerical velvet, which uses the symbols of the cross, the skull, hammer, and nails as repeated pattern elements. And this is a genre of velvet that was produced for clerical uses. The symbols, of course, retain their same symbolism, but that remains secondary to the pattern and the overall decorative intent of the vestment they were designed to embellish. I want to point out, because people talk about this, that there is no subject matter or materials that are particularly exclusive to decoration or immediately connote a decorative intent. Probably the most common decorative motifs are flowers and leaves, but one need only examine their use by such diverse artists as Heed, Demuth, or Georgia O'Keeffe to see non-decorative flowers. A third quality that distinguishes decoration from art is that deep space is out. Illusionism undercuts the decorative movement over the surface. Keeping this in mind, all traditional forms of decoration are made to be read flat. For example, compare the carefully controlled flatness of the decorative Persian miniature to the atmospheric depth of non-decorative Chinese landscape. 4. Pattern in itself is always decorative. It satisfies all of the foregoing criteria. Furthermore, paintings with a heavy use of pattern can be discussed in terms of their decorative content, whether or not they're ultimately considered decorative. An artist I like to think about in this context is Lucas Cranach, a Baroque painter who paid enormous amount of attention to the details of the costumes, like little slits and sleeves and pearl necklaces, which almost run away with the painting and overpower his allegory. But the mythology or subject matter or the portraiture always wins out. That doesn't mean that you can't consider or think about his decorative motifs. That also happens a lot in Renaissance painting, where you see someone standing in front of a very busy backdrop leaning on a rug with still life elements and things like that. So anyway, we now have these four qualifications to think about when we differentiate between art and decoration. There are expansiveness, a de-emphasis of subject matter, flatness, and pattern. If any of these qualities are strongly contradicted, it is a sign that non-decorative statement is intended. But their presence will not fail to yield positive results on the decorameter. I want to finish off with Oscar Wilde, an expert in examining subjects his contemporaries were fond of overlooking. The art that is frankly decorative is the art to live with. Mere color, unspoiled by mimicry and unallied with definite form, can speak to the soul in 1,000 different ways. The harmony that resides in the delicate proportions of lines and masses becomes mirrored in the mind. The repetition of patterns gives us rest. The marvels of design stir the imagination.
What do you think, Nicholas?
Oh, man. I mean, there are a couple points in there that I found very frustrating. But overall, I'm becoming more sympathetic with decoration. So I found it very enlightening.
Yeah, I know. And it's
very fun.
It's interesting to think about that in light of the other conversation we just heard, but also in terms of... the work we, I think, like to make. I mean, I think we're invested heavily in sort of a interior design model of visual arts in some ways, right? Working in furniture, partially. textiles, things like that. And, you know, we don't get to think about, I certainly haven't thought about sort of the difference between the more pictorial and the decorative in quite those terms.
Yeah. Well, you know, the word figure, which I feel like comes up a lot in craft books and decorative arts books, it stems from the words for form and for face.
I really like the discussion of the Persian carpet, actually. I think that sort of cleared up a lot of it for me.
Oh, dear. I feel like I got an earful about the Persian carpets from Morty Feldman a few years back. Jeez.
Anyway, our next sample from this vast recording. There's a lot of stuff on here. We might have to do a second week. But our next section is by John Cage, who's been on the show before with his friend Morty Feldman. But this is a really different kind of talking from John Cage, at least from the one that we had before. And from another famous talking he did where he discusses Glen Branca, which I don't think we've had the guts to air because it is a very, very strongly worded discussion of the work of Glen Branca for someone as mild as John Cage. Here's John Cage.
It was the juncture to go that way or this. Most no longer doesn't. It is just how, of the many benefits coming to us. Nervous system, pasts, just what did you say? Clearing the mind of music, we accept if I gave up my sense of accomplishment and just now of anything else. We are in Yucatan, out the window. Were we just elevated, or did we pull ourselves up? The even to yourself, just obscure, related, you in form you have in a place that works. Transformation to be done, have disappeared from daily life, they can be seen, we can measure its length, divided, and only if there isn't any is their vision on their mailing list, they send you part the same. There isn't much, some work can be found to be complete. You are kept in about how the line I drawn between the two, thus making it susceptible to divine influences, to the museum to take out a rule. Just video phone for permission. You can take out as many continued as though I were no longer there. The decision, see, that the car on our use of energy have been parked in, but I didn't. Now and then we go out to shop for lunch, or call some people, find it too much, stayed, try to get the rules I could have become if you and I could have by means or try to find some help, we could get some couscous. Sober stomach, red tapes connected, quiet mind. If they seem to be the same, I enjoy hearing from you, but make be such that it is not by paying the stones years ago. I set my mind that continues forever the sand. I make it is, each from the other, but to reconsider generosity, writing music, don't add beyond affirmation, beyond negation, koan, a sudden crash of thunder, the mind doors by many physicists white to white, nothing's changed, yet something immense that adds up to zero to keep me, there's no dust, it's biology, didn't want to hear it in the first place, dry ink, there is no mirror, and your ears, I know. Sati, printed program. But no need. Why? This soul is so simple, living in a particular at any one time. Do start with two, I have, is he does, or two. theater, no, the words. To have it be, arise, utopia, erquan, this very day. Senses tomorrow too, way works, at first seemed another beginning to have of its inhabitants and in a different way. That will be one. Four be afterward underground with others. You see cloud in sky, or Notre Dame in a final way of sound, to take the final step. Rivulet happily, I'll have in mind what the stretching of the muscles, erasing to be not there but here, previous year, where is the music? Has the same effect, or did I turn away? 3, 4, or 5, synergy. I had narrows, but I have not yet found iceberg. Good condition. My word, that rolling around. Can you say something, but not clearly, not dance? Without unpredictable, why did you repeat yourself just now? Rambling person, tell me. Dance and music figure. It didn't catch on. I be all their time dancing ground. To write music, nothing had a chance to rest, is a come accomplished multiplicity. Ran no play of power. Dancing free. In its own place, I could have been someone else, or south or north. Confusion hold them, this way and that, be made by someone else, a happening. No need to move that coin, a memory transfer. The need, same time, she is going to give a lecture to people up in Boston. I think the mind, continue. Move it all the time. That must in the right off the bat. What is the difference? I have more moving and not moving ever. Chance operations are the feelings that look all over almost immediately. But the intellect, by identifying himself, quite the other film that shows transferring, I move a keystone comedy. Other, the memory imprint exists. How to reach the impossibility of transferring from one like object to another that made a habit to reach doesn't have to follow optimum surface quality. Path, a help. Suzuki changed my mind 32 years ago. Highest purpose, be dust. Camera, now we know what comes to it. Not moving. He received those highest solve. Duration did it, and on the same floor next door. Measurements with less dust. Small details freed music from its rules. He said, I breathe. Work without work. Act like nature if we must. Otherwise earth in spring, as though following his advice he had gone underground. Feeling knew what was up. Life on a cloud. Love beforehand. Didn't know what we were. Place attention, making behavior. No desire, no dislike, with pleasure. Or do you find it producing laugh, tears? Both of them is rearrange. Time, king to what hasn't, is face not is about. It worked. And enlightenment marked on map. I ask yourself, is there any need for government? It works as well, need better to be without. Quick sound of children, a water. Superficial aspects fixes itself. Boredom, or I work. Stones and unemployment. From height regrets, thus finally the image on, as far as we can tell, I was deeply impressed. That's needed, forgotten, unattainable goal. Consider everybody, the widow, to remain inside or to open itself to with area. I left the list at home in New York that were, will be arranged in San Diego. Has been, will be that works. Intermissions will be against itself. What we haven't necessarily got, increased time and space. More so that than less of the pieces will be known an obstacle. Rams or superimposition forward. Wooden happened. No. Three. Most questions. Roratorial and evening. Origin is how it's now. But these brings to be accepted, those our track assignment is equal loudness, stereo location, morphology couldn't be heard, change the music, but they would be better off without her, begin with embrace, but it will take a long time, inability, my guess, before time's to work, to straighten. It's audible, their lives he acquired, his off-the-press news, their birthdays each day of our change the minds, news we ourselves complete, about remaining 21 others, than obscure, law cut up to make a reservoir, crime without him. Equal attention in combination are dry points, what's against it, engravings, noise burnt space to time, or of theory. Experience is a form, complexity, paralysis, extremes your mind, that's what goes far, and now it's obvious getting rid of them. Must see world as mind revolution. No concern to change the world with view vision. A look at world anarchy is practical. You by people and sound to care for the any word of earth. Another possibility of success. Alter. No gloom instead of syntax surprise. Everything between good and alphabet, life and death. We don't know at dawn and valley, things to do, what we're doing. Zen becomes confusing, South Sea Island, mountain, the breeze, desert, lake. To leave no traces, nothing in between, no need for poetry. Curiosity extended, no use, no mindedness.
Gave me chills.
Yeah. I think Johnny Cage knocked that one out of the park.
That's right. That's right. I think that unusually for Mr. Cage, this talking actually has a lot in common with our other favorite 20th century male American composer who's been on the show before as well.
Steve Roden.
Yeah, it had a. It felt a lot like a Robert Ashley piece, didn't you think?
Oh yeah, yeah, like Robert Ashley. I think. Yeah, I want to say they were doing this kind of work about the same time. Cage mostly in New York and Ashley on the West Coast.
I have to confess, I don't know too much about whether or not Cage did more work like this. I mean, I know he writes sort of poetry, but I don't know to what extent he performed it.
Oh, yeah. No, I think like the last 15, 20 years was just this stuff, and he performed it widely. I mean, there are these great recordings of his Charles Eliot Norton lecture at Harvard, which is a kind of, if memory serves, I think it's a misostic or kind of chance poem based on Walden. And then he also did the reading through Finnegan's Wake thing, which, as if Finnegan's Wake wasn't complicated enough, he cut it up through chance operations and read it back in that really sexy, soothing kind of whisper crystal style voice.
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating, isn't it? Really nice. Really nice piece.
Yeah, that one was good. Honestly, I could only brook so much of that late Cage stuff.
Totally. Totally, Nicholas. Yeah.
There's a lot of whispering in contemporary art music.
Anyway, that's been a lot. And we're going to have to wrap up this surprisingly earnest episode of The Talking Show.
Da-dun.
K-Chung Radio's
Da-dun.
Best and first. And thank you to True, as of tonight, only show dedicated to art talking. We're
thrilled.
We're thrilled to be back on top.
Thrilled.
Here, the first thing you heard Thursday morning. And a lot of really, really earnest food for thought there for us here.
Yep.
Hope so for you as well. In the audience.
Keep decorating.
Good morning.